didn't raise my arm. The windows were heavily tinted, and as near as I could tell, the vehicle didn't have any plates on the front. It dawned on me that it might be McGruder, having followed me, just checking to make sure I wasn't going to jump from the bridge, but he would have stopped, and the SUV kept moving, if slowly. I pushed off the barricade and watched it pass by my truck, unable to see anything inside except some dark shadows. Now I could see there were no plates on the back either. They had slowed to a stop and were now sitting at the apex of the overpass about 50 yards away. Maybe they thought I was in trouble. Maybe they thought I needed help. Maybe I'd find out. I unholstered my Colt and started walking toward them, but suddenly found myself running across the three lanes. I was only 10 yards from the vehicle when they hit the accelerator and pulled quickly away, leaving me standing there in the middle of the road, a long way from anything. Chapter 16. Holland crammed himself in the doorway with the mic dangling in his hand as the car swayed and slapped against the rails.
"Security to engineer, you copy?"
There was no response.
"Saunders, it's Holland."
He tried again.
"Roback, pick up. Everything all right up there?"
Lucian looked past us out the frost-scarred door at the tender and shuddered.
"No other way up to the engine than that, huh?"
I stood at the doorway and looked out the window at the fuel car now covered with snow and, worse yet, ice. Not that I know of, and it wasn't much fun when I did it earlier in comparatively mild weather and at a much slower speed. Holland turned to look at us.
"Now I'm worried. I don't think there's anybody up there."
"Oh, there's somebody up there, and if it's who I think it is, this isn't going to be easy."
"Wait, you know who's up there?"
I avoided the question with one of my own.
"You think the crew jumped off a little while back when we slowed down? Or got pushed?"
He gestured with the mic.
"Nobody's picking up. Now, if there was an emergency or something going on, there's two of them up there, and one of them should be answering."
I zipped my jacket up tighter and pulled out my scarf, tying it around my face as I'd done before.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Somebody's got to climb over that tender and into the cab.
I'm the head of security, and this train is my responsibility.
You're not dressed for it. Besides, you know how to stop this thing?"
He appeared to be at a loss.
"In theory."
"Well, I do."
He suddenly looked suspicious.
"How is that?"
"The engineer showed me."
I tugged on my gloves and handed Holland his sidearm.
"Here, you're off the hook."
He stared at me and then out the window.
"You'll never make it. There's got to be more than an inch of ice on that tender. The heat from the engine must be melting the snow just long enough for the wind to turn it into ice."
"If you've got a better idea, I'd love to hear it."
He glanced at Lucian.
"Hell with you, I've got only one leg."
I started to push past the security man when he stuck out a hand. "Not to add insult to injury, but at this speed it won't be long before we'll be coming up on the curve at Walcott Junction." Sheriff Connolly slowly fell back against the wall.
"Oh, hell."
As I glanced back at Holland, my voice was muffled by the scarf over my face.
"And?"
"We'll never make it at this speed, and when this thing derails, we're all dead."
He shuffled his feet and glanced toward the front.
"Also, that loco's not in shape to withstand this kind of speed for an extended period of time. If that boiler blows, it's going to unleash over 23,000 gallons of scalding water and steam, not to mention more than 6,000 gallons of number 5 fuel oil."
"So what should I hope for?"
"Well, with the derailment, you'll have a few agonizing moments, but if the boiler blows, you'll never know what hit you."
Turning the lever, I put a shoulder into the door and watched the thick coating of ice shatter and explode as it hit the grating and disappeared under the train. I just hoped the next thing under the train wasn't going to be me.
God hates a coward.
The vacuum slammed the door closed behind me, so I turned and grabbed onto the tender's railing. The ice on the ladder broke apart as I lifted myself up and climbed toward the top of the fuel car, barely able to see through the blistering wind. The train swung and bucked like a rodeo bull, and I lost my footing and clung there, my gloved hands slowly sliding down the glazed rails. Kicking my boots against the stair treads, I was able to dislodge enough snow to get traction and started up once more. I just made it to the top when I almost lost my footing again, but hung on. From that vantage point, I could see that the tender looked like a glacier. Ducking my head back down, I cursed and then reached over with my right hand, grabbing the rail that stretched across, using my left fist to break away chunks the size of dinner plates, a few of which flipped up and flew back at me, exploding on contact and almost taking me off the tender with them. I slid forward, pounding my fist to clear the way like an icebreaker.
I was about halfway across and thought that if I could get as far as the fill spout, I could rest a few seconds before climbing over it, but the train made a major shift. All I could think in that split second was that we'd reached the curve at Walcott Junction and were going to explode like a 500,000-pound grenade. My left hand was numb from bashing ice, so I hung on with my right like a grappling hook. One leg fell over the side, and I could feel another railing underneath. I lodged my foot for purchase, reached back, and took hold of the fill spout and slowly pulled myself on top. There was nothing ahead except snowflakes, illuminated by the lights on the front of the locomotive that parted to make way for the train, seeming to want to avoid it. I lay there thinking about whether I wanted to die, and came to the conclusion that, no, I didn't want to quite yet. I'd made it to the front edge, despite my hand and some vertigo, and could see that the heat from the engine had turned the snow there to a smothering slush. I tried to peer into the cab, but the snowmelt blew up in my face. Carefully feeling for the stairs, I pivoted, found a tread, and lowered myself down until I found another. The train swayed again, only to buck the other way. I felt my boot slip, and I fell backward, breaking my watch in the process. The Colt slipped from the back of my jeans, along with murder on the Orient Express, as I landed on the metal flooring. My head crashed with a soft, melon-like thump that left stars flashing in my eyes like heavy artillery, and all I could hear was the roar of the big locomotive as it threatened to blow apart at the seams. I lay there for a second, stretching my face. Somebody was whistling This Train. When I opened my eyes, I found the business end of a Model 6038 Special stuck against the numb, frozen skin of my forehead. "Hello, Deputy. It had to be you." Sitting in the chair in the living room of Katie's apartment, I stared into the night and tried to slow the whistling express of every thought I'd had in the last day. But I felt like the chair I was sitting in was falling backward faster than I could think. What was I going to do? What could I do? I hadn't been at this much of a loss since Martha had died, and the feeling of coming unraveled wasn't helping one bit. I remembered my father telling me that you knew you were a man when everything went bad and suddenly all eyes were on you for help. All eyes were on me now, and I had no idea what to do. There was a noise, and I turned to see Henry quietly closing the door to Lola's room. "She asleep?" "I am amazed that between Lucian snoring and dog snoring, your granddaughter can sleep at all. How about you?" He sat on the sofa and studied me. "I do not sleep nights like this one." I figured. I heard the refrigerator kick on in the kitchen and looked around at the wonderful job my daughter had done in fixing the place up. "I'll die without her, Henry." "I know." "What am I going to do?" "We will get her back." "How?" "We will find who took her, and we will find her, and we will get her back, no matter what it takes." I stared at my lap and nodded, but I didn't seem to convince him. "You need to look back to the man you once were, the portion of yourself that you have kept locked away for a very long time, because that is the man we need now." I glanced up at him. "I will tell you something I have never told you, something that will give you the heart you need for what is ahead." He leaned forward, and I could see the glimmer of the floor lamp reflecting in his dark eyes. "I am a very dangerous man, but you are far more dangerous than I. I have only given a sliver of my heart away, whereas you have given so much. You must go after and retrieve that which will make it whole." "I do not interrupt. There is one more thing which makes you absolutely dangerous. You have nothing to lose." I glanced toward Lola's door. "That is mine to protect, and you must trust in my ability to take care of her while you do what needs to be done. It will be contrary to many of the things you have come to believe, but you must cast them aside and become the furious warrior I know you to be." I nodded. There was nothing to be said. "I will leave you to these thoughts and your memories of that younger man. If you search long enough, you will find him.
Or better yet, he will find you. He stood, placing a hand on my shoulder and squeezing until it hurt. Then he let go and disappeared into the room, where the sliver of his heart lay. I stood and walked to the front door, opened it, and looked at Victoria Moretti's silhouette. She was leaning on one of the railings with a blanket wrapped around her.
"Do you guys ever shut up?"
I stepped out and joined her. "All quiet on the Western Front?" "It gets much colder, and I'm shooting somebody just so I can come inside." "Seen anybody to shoot?"
"No,
which is why I'm still out here." "Go inside and get some sleep." She nodded, then started to go, but then stopped.
"He's right, you know."
"What's that?"
"We're going to have to kill him."
She walked on, and I listened as the door quietly closed behind me. I don't know how long I stood there, looking at the alley. And I wasn't even aware of pulling the Colt 45 semi-automatic from the small of my back and holding it up in the mild glow of the streetlights. The metal gleamed, reflections racing up and down the slide mechanism, and the stag grips undulating with the ridges of the elk antlers, almost as if the weapon were breathing. I leaned forward and placed it carefully on the railing, not trusting having it in my hand at that moment. I thought about my wife, and then I thought about my daughter. Picking the 1911 A1 up again, I punched the button and dropped the magazine in my other hand, and then pulled the slide, launching around into the air and catching it. Then I sat on the railing and began thumbing each round, lining them up like soldiers on the flat surface of the redwood. I pulled the tattered old buckaroo scarf from my jacket pocket and spread it out. With my thumb, I pressed in on the knurled end of my Colt, at the same time rotating the barrel bushing a quarter turn clockwise to free the plug and recoil assembly. I removed the assembly and then rotated the plug in a counterclockwise direction, freeing it from the recoil spring. My hands began operating on their own, disengaging themselves from my mind, my fingers dancing without any conscious thought. I rotated the barrel bushing counterclockwise, disengaging it from the slide, and continued disassembling the Colt without even looking at it. Carefully, I polished the surfaces with the scarf and then set about reassembling the sidearm. When I finished, I started the process all over again, and then again, and again. I don't know how many times I did it, but my hands didn't get tired. And every time the action became faster, almost to the point where I couldn't follow it with my eyes in the half-dark. I finally began feeding the rounds back in the magazine, then slapped it home and jacked the slide mechanism back, holding it at inspection arms. I stood there in the two-handed grip as I thumbed the lever, and the thing slid home with a menacing click, the hammer hanging back like a fang. I carefully folded the bandana and tucked it back in my jacket. I stood there with the battle-ready pistol hanging from my hand, allowing the energy to seep into my limbs and mind, thinking about the things I was going to have to do. I went inside to find Vic asleep on the sofa and sat on one of the overstuffed chairs with the 45 on my knee. Tomorrow would be the beginning of a quest, but for now the sky was still dark. I wanted morning, but I wasn't going to get it anytime soon, so I did what soldiers had always done. I drew the darkness closer and rested. Then there was a noise, the sound of weight being distributed on the balcony outside. My hand came to rest on the pistol. I waited, but there was no more noise. Carefully, I uncoiled from the chair, the air sucking back into the cushions like the furniture was attempting to hold its breath. I pivoted toward the deck with the 45 in front of me like an antenna. It was still dark, but with the streetlights, I could see two people ducking down the steps. Vic was sitting up with her Glock aimed toward the door, and I'd just started for the bedroom when I noticed that Henry standing there, headsman of the Dog Soldier Society, Bear Clan, had filled the opening. I put a forefinger to my lips and then watched as he turned back and made the same gesture to Lucian. The bear pointed toward the window in Lola's room and then at the doorway where he stood and slid the same finger across his throat, indicating to Lucian that he should stay and protect her. Then he carefully closed the door behind him. The three of us stood there in the middle of the room.
How many?
I whispered back, at least two.
How?
Vic and I will go out, but you stay here.
If they get past me,
I want at least two more stops before they get to Lola.
He nodded, slid the stag-handled bowie knife from his back, and flipped the handle in his hand until satisfied with the grip.
The light glimmered on the blade like it had on my Colt. Just as beautiful, and just as deadly. Vic and I quietly walked toward the door. Turning the knob and gently pushing it open with my free arm, I waited. It was possible they were gone. Maybe they had heard me assembling and reassembling the weapon. Maybe they'd looked in the windows and seen me sitting there armed. Like I said, it was possible. But it wasn't likely. Staying near the jamb, I unlatched the storm door and pushed it open wide. There was still nothing, so I took a small step out, panning the Colt across the deck. Someone sat whistling, "This Train." Keeping the gun on the figure, I came the rest of the way out.
No need to worry. My friends are gone.
The rasp of his voice struck me like a whip, but I didn't respond. Backlit by the streetlights, he gestured weakly toward the steps.
There's no way I could have made it up here on my own. So my friends were kind enough to carry me.
I said nothing as Vic came up beside me, also aiming her weapon.
They were very quiet, but I assured them you'd hear.
Gesturing toward Vic, he continued.
Or your friends would.
He paused.
You look good, Walt. Better than the last time I had the opportunity to kill you.
He shouted, to be heard over the thunderous internal combustion of the locomotive.
Surprised to see me?
I started to reach a hand up to massage my neck, but he stopped me, jamming the muzzle of the stainless Smith & Wesson into my forehead. The wig was gone, but he still had the facial delicacy that had made him a beautiful woman, and the husky voice that had helped give him away. Kim LeClerc sat back in the engineer's seat and studied me as I studied him. He still wore makeup, but now it was smeared in a sad parody of femininity. The pantsuit and heels were gone. He was wearing the insulated coveralls and logger boots that had been in Gibbs's toolbox. I shouted back,
I don't suppose you're going to let me shut this engine down?
No.
Then we're all going to die.
He gestured outside where the freezing night rushed by.
You can jump!
I started to turn and sit up, but he leveled a 38 at me again. I slumped against the brakeman's bench seat and shouted to be heard above the noise of the engine.
Thanks for the offer, but no thanks. I let the engineer and crewman off. If you'd been here, I would have let you off too. I don't like killing the innocent.
Really? There's a whole trainload of them behind us.
He didn't seem to know what to say to that.
I'm going to stand up, and I'm going to pull that lever back, and we're going to let all these people live because this has gone far enough.
I took my hand and shoved his boot off my chest.
Now you can shoot me if you want, but that's what I'm going to do.
He leveled the revolver at me again.
No, you're not.
I ignored the pain in the back of my head.
Look, one of two things is going to happen here pretty soon. Either this thing is going to blow apart, or it's going to hit the curve at Walcott Junction and skip the track, so one way or another, I'm pulling that lever.
No,
he shrugged.
Sacrifices are going to have to be made. The one that could did nothing about my sister, and now they're all going to pay.
The sheriffs?
Yes.
Like Marv Leland?
He paused, turning in a little from the cold, or maybe his feelings.
I didn't want to kill him, but he was about to find me out.
I waited, giving him the opportunity to tell his story. I'd found that few people give up the chance to explain themselves, no matter what the reason or environs.
She was my sister.
Melanie Wheeler.
Yes.
Moving a hand behind my back, I started to shift my weight, but he aimed the S&W at my head and placed the work boot back on my chest.
You knew?
Eventually.
Bullshit, there's no way!
He studied me, trying to get a read on whether I was telling the truth or not.
How?
The conversation I had with Ed Schaefer at the asylum for the insane. I sat up a little, noticing my .45 lodged near his feet, along with the paperback far out of reach.
Ed said that both he and his brother left your sister alive that night.
His eyes widened a bit.
The night you killed her.
He said nothing.
For whatever reason, you were there and saw your sister with the two of them and then killed her.
I sat up a bit and my hand bumped into something under the seat.
Why, Kim?
Carefully, I ran my hand along the length of the big box-end wrench that the brakeman had left underneath the seat.
Was it because she was a woman and you weren't? Shut up!
I lifted the big wrench just enough to slide my fingers underneath, tightening my grip.
Was that how it started? You killed your sister and then killed another young woman on that same date for the next 5 years in some sort of crazy memoriam? Shut up! But when John Schaefer arrested his own brother last year, you had to stop or risk giving yourself away.
His breath heaved, and he didn't deny it.
So you attempted to get on the train with Schaefer. Yep, he told me. And when he wasn't game, you went with McKay?
I raised my voice even louder.
Or did you just get so desperate you decided to kill every sheriff on the train?
He sat there, looking at me. The wind was deafening, and the train shifted again, shuddering as it tried to stay on the tracks.
You killed Marv Leland because he was figuring things out. And then you killed George McKay with Lucian's weapon, and when that wasn't enough to muddy the trail, you chopped his arm off to convince us that he was Leland.
I waited for some sort of response, but none came.
You killed 6 young women, and now you've killed 2 more people. I'm not going to let you kill an entire trainload simply because you can't come to terms with the fact that you killed your sister.
I felt the weight of the chromed steel in my hand.
You're sick, Kim. No, you need help.
The elongated snub-nosed revolver shifted a little, so I swung the wrench at him as hard as I could. It struck his cheek, and the gun went off, firing around up and behind me. I grabbed his leg and pulled, then grasped his wrist and slammed it against the metal floor. The .38 slid away as I placed a knee on his chest and held him there, clutching his face and sobbing, the blood leaking from his fingers. Scooping up my Colt, I stood and kept it aimed at him. Reaching up, I slowly pulled the lever back, and the screaming of the engine began dying down, our speed immediately diminishing. I looked at the frozen landscape and thought about the body of the one-armed sheriff still lying out there somewhere. Then my eyes dropped to the man at my feet, and the paperback lodged under his side, and I thought about what Leland had said, that there were only so many permutations to the whodunit. He did it, she did it, nobody did it, and they all did it. As I lodged the .45 in my jeans, sat on the brakeman's bench and listened to Kim Wheeler, a.k.a. Leclerc, weep, I thought, I guess she didn't figure on this one.
Where's my daughter?
He wheezed.
I'll get to that. But how have you been, Walt?
I ignored the question, still holding the muzzle of the Colt aimed at his so-called heart.
Come on now, it's been so long since we've talked. I mean, you can't count all those parole hearings where we were sitting opposite each other in the courtroom.
He sighed and paused a moment, trying to catch what was left of his breath.
Before I forget, I've got something for you.
He extended his hand, a small, stiff piece of paper between his fingers. I reached out and took what appeared to be a postcard, tucking it in my shirt pocket without looking at it. Where's my daughter?
You might want to read that.
He sat there, fumbling with something in his lap, then looking back to me.
Now, is this any way to greet an old friend? I've gone to a lot of trouble to get here to see you.
He turned his head and sighed.
Made a lot of deals.
Who with?
The devil, I suppose, but I'll get to that.
He turned his head and laughed.
A meeting decades in the making.
As his face swiveled back to mine, the streetlights caught the dented portion of his cheek where the wrench had hit him and ruined his face.
You know, I don't think I knew what I was doing when you and I had our confrontation all those years ago. letting you take my life?
Where's my daughter? He coughed, and then his voice sharpened.
I guess we're not in a giving mood, huh?
His gaze turned to Vic standing beside me.
Hello, young lady. And how are you?
Fine. Actually trying to decide if I fucking shoot you now or later.
You work with this brute, or is it more than that?
He choked a small laugh and adjusted himself on the railing, where I could now see that he held a small semi-automatic pistol. Where's my daughter?